And our political commentators right now, it is Bridget Morton and Neil Jones. Kia ora korua and welcome.
Morena.
Morning.
Now, disclosures this morning, Neil's firm does work with a range of firms in the green business space, including electric vehicles. When we're talking climate change and related policies, probably both of you have got tangentially, and some cases more directly, clients who have interest in the area. But thank you for that declaration. And let's begin with that. So the Climate Commission's final report landed, or was made public rather, last week, and in the first kind of announcement since, we had the electric vehicles announcement yesterday, which is rebates, discounts effectively for electric vehicle buyers, and some punishment at the other end if you are driving some very older, larger vehicles, which may well prompt some interesting controversy and discussion. We did a lot on the Climate Commission last week, so let's just kick off, Neil, with your take on the final report. But to that question again, the fact that government now has to actually put some policy against it.
Exactly. And so I think there was nothing particularly revolutionary that came out from the final report that we hadn't seen in the draft. But what it does do, I think, is it really means that the rubber hits the road now. We've had 4 years now of the government sort of setting up frameworks and setting up processes and institutions. And we've had a sort of thing where parties give their reckons about what they think we should and shouldn't do. Now we've actually got three carbon budgets. We've got some pretty steep targets. And parties actually have to be able to show, how am I going to make policies that reduce these emissions? And that's what I think the government's challenge is. And we're already seeing that with the EV and biofuels announcement over the weekend. And I think for them, for the government, the challenge is going to be, how do you do this in a way, you know, restructure our economy in a way that doesn't create public angst? But for the National Party, their question is, they can't forever say we support action but oppose every action. At some point, they're going to have to come up with some answers.
I think they can. I think this is one for the government because it is in power. It's legislation that's being given effect during its term of office, and it is the one that's got to introduce the policies now, Bridget. And is there trouble brewing here? It's interesting just hearing in Switzerland from our Europe correspondent this morning, a public referendum has just kiboshed their whole Paris climate commitments plan, right? So that's fairly direct democracy. But, you know, are they now getting into territory where people are going to get hacked off because things are going to directly affect them?
Well, I think it's that sort of layering effect. It's, you know, how many things are going to affect how I live my life? You know, some people are like, well, that's a cost. Maybe I won't buy that vehicle next year or this year, or I won't install gas, or I will. But if they're doing multiple decisions of things that they want to do, that's when people are going to feel really hard hit. And I think particularly we're going to have, you know, some traditional sectors that are going to be particularly hit by some of these things disproportionately to, you know, people like me, frankly, who are lawyers in a city, you know, in terms of what's going to affect me on a day-to-day basis, quite different to people in industries, you know, in manufacturing industries and farming and all of that sort of side of it. I think what was interesting and what's going to be difficult for the government too is the Climate Commission provided advice on how to reach that the emissions target. But what they didn't do is go through all that cost and benefit analysis of how much it impacts each individual. So there's sort of a level or threshold put out there that the government, you know, has to act in the way that the Climate Commission said.
Or do the equivalent. Yeah.
But every time they move away from the Climate Commission, they're going to get hit by the left who say, well, why are you not going as hard and doing as much as what the Climate Commission wanted, as well as what we're talking about getting hit on the other side by people getting affected?
There's also lurking here in this potential here for National, which is learning to modulate its responses on these things. But there is this line that actually the ETS alone, properly functioning, could probably get us to, you know, strictly to the letter of the law, what we've signed up to. Now, there's an opportunity for National to carefully get back to, yes, of course, we're committed to meeting our targets, but we don't have to do all this.
And I've seen that argument. The New Zealand Initiative's been running it quite hard, and National seems to have picked it up, that, yeah, don't actually do any climate policies, have the ETS, have a cap, and the market will get us there. And superficially, that's quite attractive. However, it's a kind of green Thatcherism. Last time we had kind of just leave it to the market to run when we restructured our economy, we had the huge upheavals of the 80s. I think the reality that National will face if they go down that line is, you know, they side with every reactionary farmer who doesn't want to see trees planted in rural New Zealand. If you left it to the ETS, the cheapest way to reduce emissions is pine forest carpeting New Zealand. They wouldn't like that. They don't want to bring agriculture into the ETS. And moreover, you would have quite uneven impact. So, for example, you wouldn't see that kind of shift in the vehicle fleet. You wouldn't see the investment in public transport. You'd see basically poor people suddenly not being able to drive. You'd see strategic industries, New Zealand Steel, would shut down. You know, there are huge impacts that come from that. So it's
is there a middle path that National could walk that says we're committed, we believe in ramping up the ETS, and they've got a problematic history with that that we'll get into, but could they deal to some niche demographics, and particularly some of their voters they're trying to attract back by changing the rule book here?
Yeah, I think we just need to probably be really careful here that the New Zealand Initiative has put it out there around, you know, ETS, the market, etc. But that is not, I haven't seen that from National's policy. And I think, you know, just, you know, yesterday you saw the reaction to the EV announcement. It was much more nuanced, as you're saying, Catherine. It was, you know, pushing back against the tax on the higher emitting vehicles, but supporting incentives in other areas. And I think that's what you're going to see more of, is the fact that, like, yes, there's choices to be made here, but we can do it in ways that doesn't hurt people who have no choice.
Its problem with the ETS also is that it was in power when the decision was made to allow the junk credits into the country, and that effectively it sunk the carbon price. I think it got as low as, I'm working from memory, it's like $2, right? So you can't say, hey, this is the methodology that can get us there, without your history of having completely undermined it, frankly.
Well, I think that's true, but I think you've also got to be careful that, you know, things have moved on, and I think the mood of the country in terms of climate change action is moving, and that the parties will have to follow that. Therefore, you have to allow them to have the ability to be more nuanced and change as necessary.
Well, can I just say, my message to the National Party would be, if you're looking at your response on climate change, look to Boris Johnson's Conservative Party, which is actually taking climate change a lot more seriously, and don't look to the Republicans in the US. You know, they need to have constructive ways they're actually going to deal with climate change and not just oppose.
The temptation, yes, that's true.
And because the public expect it.
But the temptation will be, the public do expect it, but the public also is about to feel some of the pain. And there's no one public. There's a whole bunch of people living individual lives, living corporate lives and families and in organisations. And yes, they may all be mentally in the same space that something has to be done about this. But when it's your farm vehicle that you feel threatened over and you're asking, is my Hilux in this or out of this, or is my this or that in or out of it? You saw the reaction to that bridge over troubled waters, I'm calling it now, the Waitemata.
Well, it was a silly bridge.
It's a silly bridge, and Labor was taken aback by the strength of the feeling. Because that, again, is what happens when you take your eyes off the policy and start, you know, not thinking about the people affected.
I guess the point is, though, we now have mathematics to deal with. Like, now we have carbon budgets. If we're going to meet our targets, there has to be pain put somewhere. So my point is, National can oppose various measures. They can't just rely on the ETS unless they want to hold of unintended consequences. So they are going to have to...
They're not in government.
I know, but at some point, yeah. Right now they can get away with it and just oppose everything. But at a certain point, voters want to know, do you have a credible plan, and does it add up? And if it doesn't add up, we know what happens when you do that.
What do they do when irritation does start coming up with various parts of these plans?
Well, I think just, you know, stepping back here a little bit, you've got to acknowledge that the climate change emission, if they were to take all of those policies holus bolus, there's a lot of unintended consequences, because that consequential and the externalities have not been fully examined in the report. That's what the government has to do over the next couple months.
And they won't take all of the Climate Change Commission exactly, because some of their analysis, frankly, is pretty half-baked. But I think that what will happen is the government will put out an emissions reduction plan at the end of the year. They will make concrete steps. And I'm just saying, the National Party has to actually have a plan to meet those budgets and not just oppose it.
And I'm asking what National does when they start to detect public backlash on certain areas of actual policies that are introduced. What do they do?
Well, I think if they are serious about their statements that they support action on climate change, they have to do nuance. They can't just go for the full, this should be completely taken off the table. And as they go back to, you know, I think yesterday's response on the EVs was exactly right. They looked at where the people were hurting. They went, actually, that is completely unfair, because there's not alternative, you know, utes for tradies and farming vehicles currently available. But also said, but on the other hand, we do support incentives for EVs.
But the phrase was reverse Robin Hood. So that targeted on the fact that the cheapest cars, we discussed this with the Commissioner, 4 million cars out on the road in New Zealand, we're buying more than, you know, it continues to rise. We're buying tons of SUVs, by the way, and not for farm use. But what they're honing in on there is that people who can pick up the cheapest cars off Trade Me are the ones who are going to get punished here. However, if you don't start to disincentivise one, how are you ever going to incentivise the other when there's still, as someone pointed out, a $30,000 gap?
And can I just say two things? First of all, they weren't clear about their view on incentives. Stuart Smith came out, the climate change spokesperson, said they don't support incentives, and the transport spokesperson, Michael Woodhouse, said they did on the same day. So I'm not even sure where they settled it. Secondly, it doesn't affect your second-hand car on Trade Me. So this whole, you know, taking from the poor, minimum wage workers are not buying $70,000 Ford Rangers. They're buying second-hand cars off Trade Me.
So back to you, Bridget. I guess what I'm getting at, are they in position at the moment? Are they ready at the moment to begin to respond to some real issues that are going to start landing? Or are they still a bit hit and miss in terms of how they're going to do this?
I think they really have to sit down and look at this issue as a big policy argument. I do think in terms of what Neil's saying, that they have to be able to put, you know, constructive things on the table as well as opposition. They absolutely need to, because, you know, without, you know, just basically they have to achieve the law, the legislative requirement in terms of the target that they voted for. So they can't pretend that doesn't exist.
They can highlight, however, the cost blowouts and some of the road transport projects that are now back on the table but had been delayed, which is coming at this a different way. It's coming at some of the frustration that may well emerge a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, this, what concerns me probably about this sort of next 6 months and the policy decisions that they do make is that we've seen a record from Labor of not looking at the cost-benefit analysis of policies. You know, we just talked about the cycle bridge across the harbour. It's one example. Where's the cost-benefit of that and going whether or not that delivers, you know, triple bottom line, you know, in terms of what does that actually deliver for New Zealanders? And so my concern is that instead of, you know, the next 6 months going, actually, okay, what are the costs and benefits and who this is going to affect, instead we're going to end up with a virtue signalling, you know, budget at the end of the year of how they're going to get to emissions. And that is exactly where National can come in and push back on that cost-benefit analysis.
Interesting.
Which is different to absolutely denying any action on climate change.
That's interesting. So, okay. Now, the other emerging irritation here, and it's going to go beyond an irritation. The Minister Farfoy announced a visa extension for 10,000 foreign workers. You have still got hospitality saying we are limiting hours and we are shutting up shop in some instances because we cannot get enough workers. You've got that coming from other sectors as well. You've got the Building Industry Council, I think, putting out stats showing that Wellington alone, the capital alone, is short of construction workers by something like 140%, and it's got some massive projects coming. There's no doubt these constraints are really going to put a squeeze, not only on individual projects, but on the economic recovery. Now, again, is there room for National to get in here and say, hey, look, we could be doing this differently?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're seeing that from Erica Stanford. You know, she's made a really big push from National on terms of, you know, those families that have been split by COVID that have this uncertainty. You know, this latest decision, basically, it's a whole lot of bunch of people had 1 month to go on their visa extensions. 1 month is nothing when you're trying to plan whether or not you need to shift your life, you know, to another country or whether you don't have to do so. And uncertainty for businesses in terms of their business planning, where their staff are going to be and where they're going to come from. So I think absolutely National is making the case in this space, and there is a lot of people that are not getting a voice.
And the Aussie recruiters are here, Neil. They're here. And what are we doing to keep our people?
Yeah, and I guess the government would say they're doing higher wages, et cetera, et cetera. I agree with Bridget on the need to help migrants who are here bring their families in. I think that is something the government has to act on.
It hasn't acted on it month after month.
And they do need to. And I think, you know, one of the constraints has been MIQ, but I think you just say you can book like anyone else, and if there's room available, you can come in. On the broader issue of skill shortages, obviously where there are skill shortages, we should be bringing people in as we can. We do have closed borders, so it is difficult. You know, it's not a simple case.
So does Oz. You know, this is the thing. It's not even about bringing people in, although that's part of it. It's about not losing what we've got. Like, where is there a package? Where is there any message out there right now, if you are a nurse or a construction worker or in hospital for that matter, to say, we are going to keep you here, we're going to do what it takes? Where is that message?
What does that look like, though?
Some incentives, you know.
What, we're going to pay you $20,000 not to leave New Zealand?
But I think in terms of you've got to
settle
have that,
your nurses
that aspirational
agreement quick yeah. enough.
Well, that's one of the things. It's, you know, that sort of
don't
aspirational,
offer them
can
sub,
I?
Honestly, sub-inflation well, levels.
I think what we're seeing here is the blowback on that ridiculous pay freeze announcement. I mean, and I think that's probably inflamed the situation.
But it's actually the negotiations as well. I know there's a negotiations process between 20-odd DHBs that are about to be disbanded. But this is potentially crisis stuff. You've got empty beds in Christchurch Hospital for the sole reason there's not enough nurses.
Well, you're not going to hear me argue against workers getting pay rises.
So where is there a sense of urgency or doing things differently because this is the time that we're in?
Well, I mean, I guess that's why they extended those 10,000 visas, is because while the government has a goal to get New Zealand employers to pay locals better and train locals, that's going to take time, and they're going to need to have everyone they can right now, because you don't want that handbrake on the New Zealand economy as we're
recovering.
But
you've got to have certainty in your immigration settings. You know, you've got to have certainty that if you do come here, you can bring your family, you know, across, or that you can be here for a couple of years and that you're not going to have uncertainty. So I think, you know, they promised, was it a month ago, this big immigration reset of, you know, we're only bringing in skilled migrants and this sort of thing, without ever addressing the issue of basically who we've got on the ground right now and the immediate need now. Nothing has come out of
we
that immigration reset.
We had Paul Spooney last week say, just give these current visa holders, just give them residency. Just do it. Just, you know, these are not normal times.
And I don't think
very slow-moving normal policy procedures.
And I don't think giving 10,000 people residency would be the end of the world, you know. Why not just do it?
Okay. Where are we? What else are we talking about today? There was one other topic that we were going to talk about before we got to the fundraising stuff. Oh, the vaccine announcement stuff. Look, it got very mucky last week. We know that supplies are running down. We know that we're going into stockpiles for the positive reason that many more vaccines are happening a day. I think it's up to about 16,000 a day now. A lot of confusion over last week's numbers. It seems like there was poor communication of the next arrival coming and what that would top numbers up to. But there was also a sigh of relief that it looks like there will be a decent dollop coming now late July from Pfizer. Again, enough to calm the horses, Bridget, or still very opaque?
It's really opaque, I think. And I think for the reason that, you know, we've still got people, you know, that are bordered or border adjacent, should you say, these are the families and things that are not vaccinated. And we're relying fully on that border to keep us safe at the moment. And I think also, you know, the confusion about numbers last week, which seemed to complete and utter communications mess. When you don't get those numbers right and you don't look like you've got certainty in what you're telling the public, it undermines the whole sort of, you know, process. If people were concerned, you know, those sort of vaccine hesitant people like, oh, I'm not sure whether, you know, this is, I can trust in this and what's happening. Those little things like last week niggle away at that the government's not telling the whole story and they need, you know, to be coming clean on
it. I will stick up for them. We want numbers and we want facts, and we get frustrated when we don't get facts and we just get vague statements. But just don't stuff up your numbers.
But also, like,
just make them clear.
Why are they opposing, and I do not understand this, why are they opposing Ashley Bloomfield turning up, you know, to a select committee to talk about these issues and getting it more on the record? I think, you know, Nationals made multiple attempts to get them, you know, get him in front of a select committee, a health select committee, and the, you know, Labor MPs are continuing to oppose that. Why would you do that when you can see last year that those open communications, that continuous flow of information is what people felt secure and acted on?
Do they simply not know enough to be happy doing that?
Look, I don't know why, but what I would say is that I think there's a lot of panic around the vaccine stuff, and a lot of people jumping at shadows and accusations of hiding things. And what we saw last week was a simple case of someone in the Ministry of Health providing numbers to the government to an inquiry that didn't include the continual week-on-week announcements. You know, Ministry of Health figures, you know, not quite sure, we'll have to look into it, do they add up? It's a lot different from the Herald running breaking news, vaccines to run out on Monday. I think that was a little bit over-egged, if we're honest, and probably scared a lot of people that didn't need to. And there is some room for responsibility in reporting these things, because I understand there has been quite a spike in panic phone calls to Healthline and so forth by people thinking they weren't going to get vaccinated. The thing is, I mean, the government has a huge challenge ahead of it. There's a lot that could go wrong between now and the end of the year, and they never know, you know, really until quite late in the piece whether the Pfizer deliveries are going to arrive. But I think we just need to just step back a bit and say there will be problems, there'll be mistakes, there'll be stuff-ups, just like we had with MIQ, just like we had with everything. But overall, we're getting vaccinated. The numbers are tracking well. Vaccine hesitancy is going down. I think we just need to calm a bit.
The problem is, Bridget, if we get another outbreak, or hell will break loose.
And you've just got to see the public perception in Melbourne.
You compare us with Australia. It's the same situation. You get criticised if you go in and try and hoover up a whole bunch of supplies that countries with people dying need. You're negotiating with a global giant anyway. You don't get to dictate exactly what you get. You need to negotiate. I think there will be ground for National in the future to say, and Chris Bishop has done this, were we just too late from beginning to end, despite being told we're at the front of the queue? But the real, the patients will run out, or the concerns will raise if we had another outbreak here.
Yeah.
And to be fair to them, touch everything that's wooden in the studio since March. We haven't had another breach via the border.
I don't think there's any wood in the studio, Catherine.
Okay. Just my noggin. Again, this is one where National's got to play it both ways. It's got to say, yes, they could do better, but we don't want bad things to happen. And we're glad and overall, you know.
Yeah, nobody wants another outbreak to happen. Absolutely. And you can just see, you know, what happened to Victoria. You know, the anger of them going into another lockdown wasn't actually directed at the state. It was actually directed mostly at, you know, the federal system and the vaccines and how they felt they hadn't gotten the vaccines. And it comes back to me again of people feeling secure and knowing when they're going to get the vaccine. You know, I thought really interesting last week, the medical association coming out and saying GPs were as much in the dark as about the vaccines as the general public was. And for me, who's expecting probably to get my vaccine through my GP, that's concerning to me and going, well, what does that mean? Like, when am I, you know, how's that going to change, you know, my sort of plans?
The problem is that there's only a certain amount to know, to Neil's point. But what you do know, you do have to communicate accurately and not leave.
Can I just say as well, I'm a bit confused at what National would do differently.
Just that they should have been started earlier in negotiations. But they should have been, you know.
But I mean, honestly, like they haven't said we shouldn't do a Pfizer-only rollout. They haven't said that. The closest I've seen is Chris Bishop on Twitter saying we should have paid more. I don't know if that's even feasible, but if it is, it would be deeply immoral for a wealthy, developed country like New Zealand with no COVID to steal vaccines from India. I don't know what National would do differently.
All right. Two emerging stories that we might return to, actually. I think it's worth touching on this today. There's a little story popped up on Stuff, which is why we will, which is the sources of fundraising, or rather the sources of donation to parties. Bridget, do you want to kick off on this with a little bit of context? There's been quite a few kind of embarrassing situations revealed of late. And what's it saying overall about donation origin and the rules around, not only the rules around, but the kind of the due diligence around?
Well, I think, first of all, the fact that just with electoral donations, there is no perfect system. If somebody wants to rig the system or somebody is corrupt, they will find a way to work around the system. I think what's really important in the electoral donation space is transparency. And, you know, you say there's a series of sort of embarrassing stories. That came because somebody literally went through the publicly available records and found where donations were coming from, was able to trace them back. So I think that's actually something that we should, you know, sort of celebrate in terms of our system, is that that information is available. I think, you know, people are always going to have suspicions about why people donate to political parties, in the same way they're going to have suspicions of why people volunteer for political parties or spend their time anywhere near politics. So I don't think you're ever going to get around that with any kind of system.
So what were some of the cases that came to light? Was this a member of the public or was it a politician who did this research?
So there was, it was a journalist from Newsroom that did a sort of series of stories around this, but it kind of is highlighted. I think there's sort of three-ish kind of stories in this space in the last sort of leap. One is around Stuart Nash. You know, he's now forestry minister. He has donations from forestry companies, and whether or not that was, you know, conflicting and whether or not he should give them back. You know, the Green Party was found to have taken quite a large substantive donation from a person that has now been convicted as an animal welfare
abuser.
Thank you. And, you know, whether or not they should give that back or use that for another purpose. And then the question, the story sort of coming out today about, you know, Labor, you know, running a business conference in which you can get, you know, I think for close to $2,000, you can spend time in a room with the people.
There was another one about Phil Twyford got a donation for $2,000 from a guy who turned out to be a raving anti-Semite. But I think Twyford did the right thing. He paid that back straight away when he found out.
What of this business of tickets to get in a room where politicians are? I mean, that happens all the time if you're with business groups, business breakfasts, whatever, right? But is it different when you are selling it as a fundraiser? And I think National's been here before. What was it it used to run?
The Cabinet Club.
Cabinet Club. Is it starting to get a bit uncomfortable?
Look, I think the nature, as Bridget says, the nature of our fundraising system is that parties have to go and shake the bucket and say to private interests, will you fund my political party? And there are legitimate public concerns about that. I mean, we have nearly every party is under investigation by the SFO. So I mean, there are this is the nature of it. So look, any party, I guess what I'd say is any party that fundraises, when they take a donation, they know that they may be judged by the public for taking that donation.
But when you specifically articulate as pay a ticket and you'll be able to mingle with, you know?
But that sort of, I mean, we've just got to be a little careful here. Yes, I mean, A, first of all, it's open and transparent. The fact that the invitation is out there for this particular Labour one, and the fact that, you know, it's a story and the stuff here, and everyone knows, you know, about it. So, you know, it's going to be really clear who sort of attends and what, you know, happens. I think, you know, there's lots of opportunities for industry groups and stakeholder groups. You know, chambers of commerce have events with ministers all the time.
The people who get the access tend to come from the business sector. They can pay for the tickets, they host the events. Do you have the same with other groups?
What I would say is that within the rules in the system we have, what Labour has set up is entirely within the rules, and parties, MPs are allowed to fundraise and they're allowed to hold conferences. I would rather personally we didn't have any of this and we just had state funding. And if we're going to go down that route of, you know, quite legitimately having concern about how our system is funded, that is the way out of it, state funding. I think as long as we have a system where we have rules and we have parties have to shake the bucket, things like this will happen, and you judge them on whether they follow the rules.
How does it compare also to access through Parliament itself and who has swipe cards and who doesn't? And that will be a lot of business interests. It'll be a hell of a lot of lobbyists, including the pair of you.
I don't. I never applied for one.
Okay.
I was just lazy, though.
Say, I've had a parliamentary pass.
Okay. But others will. Lobby groups will. Advocacy groups will. Interest groups will.
But once again, it comes down to the fact of, well, what is open and transparent? And one of the things that I do really think is good that's been the last couple of years is ministerial diaries have, you know, been publicly released, and you can see who people are meeting with within their ministerial capacities, and that, you know, puts some pressure on for them to make sure that they are meeting with everyone else in their stakeholder groups. Because I think the danger really comes down to, if the only people you're meeting with are people that are aligned with your political values, you are not doing your job as a minister.
However, I think we should have absolute transparency on lobbying. We should have a lobbyist register. We should have everything published. And I think more than that, we should have state funding of political parties. We don't have that, so we just have to try our best with the rules we have.
This sticks its head up. I've mentioned it the second time of reading Michael Cullen's memoir at the moment. I'm going to interview him next week on it, Political Memoirs. And it sticks its head up. You know, we have these dramas every 5 or 10 years and we never get the reform. And is it because you will never get agreement across the parliament?
The thing is, everyone wants to go to heaven, but no one wants to die, right? So, like, we all want money out of politics, but none of us want to actually pay for it.
All right. Thanks, both of you. Neil Jones and Bridget Morton.